session number 22584, Reel 1.
Right. Jim Hogg, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Hull.
Which year was this?
1919.
Did your ancestors come from Hull?
No, my father was born in Glasgow, Paisley, in actual fact, and mother, County Durham.
And did you grow up and have your schooling in Hull?
I was everything in Hull, yes. I went to the infant school, Selby Street West. Then we opened a new school where we lived, in Gypsyville, Francis Askew. I transferred there until there was no more room left, so we went back to Selby Street West. And then in 1930, I had a scholarship to the Hull Grammar School, which, of course, in those days was in Leicester Street.
Can you give me as much detail as you can about your memories of what Hull Grammar School was like then, including the teachers?
I spent 4 out of 5 years with Mr. Pete, who was known as Carlo Pete. Does that ring a bell with you?
It does.
He was the form master. I hoped that I would take German, but I was put in the Latin class, and so I had Latin with Mr. Pete for the rest of my school year from the lower fourth. First form master was George Cawthra, who was the third forms. We had Mr. Smith, who for some unknown reason was known as Tostig. And this, of course, came from the history, the battle at Stamford Bridge between Harold and Tostig, one of the opponents. It was a name that he must have been given by boys after 1919, because most of these men were returned from the First World War. And whether he liked it or not, that was his nickname. And we had a Mr. Hargreaves, who was maths. We had a charming Frenchman who taught French, Mr. Catlan, who came from Alsace-Lorraine, I believe. We had a geography teacher who actually retired at the end of my school time in the grammar school. And I'm just for the life of me trying to think of his name, but it's not there. We had a man called Williams, who was for some reason called Knit Williams, who was the music man, and he retired at that time. One of the characters of the school was Mr. Wade. Now, Mr. Wade was the PE man, and he, of course, had come back from the First World War, where obviously he had been a sergeant major, I believe, but he certainly handled the PE department at the grammar school very well. And I believe he retired to what were known as the bridge bungalows at Cayingham, I think. Carlo Preet, of course, lived in the schoolhouse, if you remember. Well, you wouldn't, at Leicester Street. There were some houses that belonged to the school. They weren't all occupied. Those that were empty were used as storerooms and things like that.
What kind of an education was provided in those days?
Very good, I always thought. It was very basic. It was all aimed at matriculation. I mean, that was the whole, as far as I could see, you know, we swatted up these subjects, and at the end of it all, we took matriculation school certificates in English, maths, science, chemistry, art and architecture, and languages, French, Latin in my case.
Was there much of a sense of tradition in the school?
Oh, yes, yes. And actually, 1935 was an outstanding year for the number of those who succeeded in obtaining their certificates. 1936 was even better, but I'd left then. But I've still got school magazines upstairs for that particular period. I enjoyed my school. I did, really.
Were Heimers the local rivals?
Oh, yes. Well, now, there's a different thing, you see. When it came to choosing your schools in preference, if you succeeded with the scholarship, I belonged to the group who said, no, I don't want to go to Heimers. They're all snobs. That was the sort of picture that we had. I mean, my father was a coppersmith and an ordinary working man. And at the time, beginning of the 30s, when things were very bad, he wasn't unemployed, but he was on week on and week off. My relatives up north were coal miners, and they were out of work for 3 years. It was a very, very bad time.
But you were saying that Heimers were not really the rivals?
Heimers, not in that sense. They were somewhat aloof, you know. There were quite a lot of fee-paying people in Heimers. There were fee-paying at the grammar school, actually.
But you didn't pay a fee?
Oh, no. I paid nothing. No. I wouldn't have gone. In fact, a number of my friends, of course, did not take up scholarship because the family could not afford it.
So who paid for you?
The scholarship. But that was still an expense. And my family were prepared to give up whatever was necessary.
Because they couldn't rely on a wage from you?
Well, no, it wasn't always adequate. I mean, we got £2 a year from the corporation to pay for what was required. Became very adept at selling books and buying second-hand ones. So that your first year was the most expensive, you know. You've got to buy your PE kits and your PE shoes and football.
How much did
gear.
The corporation get?
£2 for a year.
£2?
£2. Old money. Yes. And, of course, that group that I brought up with there, incidentally, there were a number, all added. Well, unfortunately, the right age to be called up, as many were. I mean, we were 20 when the war broke out, which was the age when, even before the war started, they decided, view the situation, that they would call up, as militiamen, those who were 20 years of age.
Before we go on to the war, what was Hull like as a place to live in the 20s and 30s?
It was quite nice. It was, yes. I was quite pleased. We all felt it was the end of the line. The railway didn't go any further, not in that sense. I know we went to Hornsey and Munsey, but it was in a way the end of the line. But it was growing. I mean, 1930 saw the building of North Hull Estate and Preston Road. And when they were built, I mean, they were nice houses. They demolished all the houses in the Ferensway area. That was Brook Street, Portland Street, or Cannon Street. All those streets, they were absolutely slum areas. And they just demolished the lot. And they took those people up into North Hull Estate. And they demolished the houses in the east side, Drypool, Hyperion Street, and bits of Williamson Street, Smivey Street, that end of Holness and Hedden Road. And they're the ones who were housed on Preston Road. As I say, I think everybody felt that they were very well made, good houses. There were all sorts of strange stories about people who moved, you know, who took the toilet seats off and thought they were all right for photos and hung them on the wall. Kept the donkey and kept the fodder in the bath. So the tales go, you know. But we had over 300,000 people then. It was quite a busy place. and we still had Hull Fair, and trams, which were very efficient for children. Halfpenny was the cost, and you could go anywhere for a halfpenny.
Were they run by the corporation?
Oh, yes, yes, the whole tramways department. And they were departments, you see, and they made a profit. The electricity was electricity department, and they made a profit. And they had the building. When they built Ferrans Way, there were two buildings that are still there today. One, of course, was the ABC Cinema, the Regal, and the other was the electricity buildings, which housed the electricity department. And of course, they produced their own electricity because we had a power station at the bottom of Ride Street off Beverly Road.
So what did you do on leaving school?
I was fortunate enough, because there was a great demand for jobs, more jobs, more people wanting work than there was work, and I got into the Guildhall, into the cleansing department, which dealt with the collection of refuse and the street cleaning. And we had a disposal in Chapman Street where the refuse was burnt. Had a huge chimney. But the interesting thing about it was that we created steam, which was sold to Reckitt's on one hand, and the Waterloo, I think, I'm pretty sure it was the Waterloo Cake and Oil Mills on the other side of Cleveland Street. Because you've got these great pipes going across the streets carrying steam.
So in what capacity did you work?
I was a clerk in the office. We weren't in the Guildhall, we were just outside. We had an office. We were on the top floor and Weights and Measures were down at the bottom.
Were you happy doing the job?
I was, yes, I was quite happy indeed.
Did you at that time, in the second half of the 30s, think a war was coming?
1938, yes. Because we were then involved with defence, air raid precautions, ARP. And people were invited to take part. And my father and I both became ARP wardens and underwent training. And when in 39 it was obvious that it would happen, our task was to fit gas masks in the area where we lived, Welbeck Street in those days, on Prince's Avenue.
Fit gas masks?
The children provide gas masks, especially ones for children, to make sure that they knew what they were doing. And that was done before the war started.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Indeed I did. I shall never forget that, because for some reason or other, it was council property, policy, I should say. It was council policy to move certain departments out of the centre of the town. Now, I don't know who decided what, except that the cleansing department would move to St. John's Primary School on Clough Road. And the day that war was declared, which might sound a bit like Rob Wilton, but on the day that war was declared, the morning of that Sunday, congregation was going to Queen's Hall, which was opposite our office, and we were lowering down through the windows desks and chairs, and they were being loaded onto dust carts and taken off to St. John's School on Clough Road. And we did hear, you know, there was a radio somewhere, and we did hear Mr. Chamberlain. But of course it was repeated and repeated, so we all knew it by heart almost.
Did you feel any sense of dismay?
Not really. You know, you just questioned, I wonder what's going to happen to me. I mean, already I'd actually gone down Walton Street in the May and volunteered for the territorials. But I wasn't accepted simply because I was 20 and the recruiting officer said, we shall be getting you anyway. And they only needed three to fit up the unit. And there were four or five of us, you see. So the decision was made on that grounds. We shall be getting you. And they did.
Why did you volunteer for the territorials?
That was the sort of appeal at that particular time. It was, you know, there was a general appeal and people felt that, well, that's something we could do. Those that did and were accepted, of course, come the 3rd of September were away and off they went. It was rather quicker than they anticipated, I'm sure.
But you had to wait.
I then waited. I thought, that's me, I volunteered, I'll not do it again. So I waited and I was called up in December 39.
What happened when you were called up?
I reported to Beverley Barracks. Which is the last thing I was going to do. I didn't volunteer for the infantry. I volunteered, actually, that particular day, it was the RAMC that were appealing for volunteers, so that's where I went. But I thought, well, there we are. When it did come, it was report to Victoria Barracks, Beverley.
What did you find at Victoria Barracks when you got there?
Well, it's on Victoria Road, the Victoria Barracks. It's on the whole road, the top road, as you go from Willoughby, actually. It is now Morrison Supermarket. But then it was a 19th century military barracks. It had been built mid-19th century, and we became members of the East Yorkshire Regiment.
What processing did you go through at first?
We were allocated to a floor in the barracks. It was three stories. Recollect we were on the top floor. It's very strange that I went with a lad I was at school with in Gypsyville. He was 20 on the 22nd of July and I was 20 on the 26th. So we're very close. And I had lost touch with him until the 15th of December when I met him again on the platform, Paragon Station, on the way to Beverley to be called up. And we were together. We went into the same section. We had a month, 2 months training, using, of course, the Westwoods for activities. And we had the usual lectures. The people who looked after us were, in one or two cases, those who had been recalled from reserve duty. Some sergeants, well, we threatened what we'd do when the war finished, but that was soon forgotten. I'd always been outside. I mean, although I worked in an office, I cycled a lot and we camped, and so living in that rough way wasn't any difficulty. What I did notice particularly was I saw the lack of manners, you know. At least I'd been brought up to say please and thank you and to use the knife and fork. And it was a bit of a, when the meal, you were in on tables, and when the meal, when it arrived, when the meal came and put onto the centre of the table, there was, at the beginning, there was inclined to be a bit of a rush. I wasn't used to that. But it wasn't long before we settled down to it.
How did the people in charge treat the recruits?
We were fortunate. They treated us very well. The only thing I did notice in one case, and it was the first time I'd ever seen this attitude shown, we had a coloured lad in our unit, our section, and one of the NCOs seemed to pick on him. We were drilled, PE, on the Westwood, and I always recollect him making this lad run round and round and round, you know, for no reason at all, except that to me it seemed that he was picking on someone who was coloured.
Which parts of the world did this lad come from?
Hull.
But what was his racial background?
No idea. I mean, we had a small number of people. Later on, I was to teach at the Boulevard, and we got one or two families who were of Arabian connection, you know, sailors, really, seamen, who had settled in Hull. And, of course, their children were coloured. But, again, I never saw any sort of racial discrimination, not in those days. It's only something I think we've created ourselves, I feel sometimes.
But you felt there was discrimination in that case?
Yeah, well, that was the first and only. Because otherwise, one lad, coloured lad, was called White. So you know what he was nicknamed. He was Chalky White, wasn't he? And he remained with us in the unit until 1944. Our unit was disbanded.
Do you think the training did you any good?
Oh, it made us fit. I thought I was fit, because I'd done such a lot of cycling, you know, and played games and so on, but, it made us fit. The only thing I remember that was distasteful, we had medicals, of course, and we had a dentist inspection too, teeth, and I'm sure these were beginners in dentistry as well. And he took three teeth from me. I'd never had any bad teeth. I don't know. I'd lost three. And I wasn't at all pleased.
Was it done without pain?
Oh, well, I remembered it. No, it was an injection, you know, in the gum, as always. But it was the injustice of it all, really, I felt. You know.
What was the next step?
Next step, after the 2 months basic, we were asked to, in a way, this was quite democratic, really, to choose what would you like to follow, signals, motor transport, or what. And I thought, well, either signalling or motor transport would please me. So I chose, I finished up in the MT platoon. And so from then on, the first thing we got, we were taught how to drive, which was very basic. It was noticeable, rememberable, in the fact that we had a vehicle, a car, or a lorry. We hadn't much stuff, really, to use. And perhaps four or five would be in a car with the instructor. And I always recollect that we generally made our journeys from Beverley in the direction of where somebody might live so we could have a cup of tea. It would seem that the course of the instruction was dictated by whose house was available. And then we drove into town. We had town driving. And at an appropriate moment, known only to those in charge, we were declared drivers. And that was it. And after the war, of course, I got a license on the fact that I'd been a trained driver in the war.
When you say it was very basic, how do you mean? Being taught to drive?
Oh, yes. As anybody would be taught to drive, I mean, you just took it in turns. And the amount of time that you would have, 15 minutes, I suppose, by the number of people that were being trained. I mean, now you see, you get a chap will come and take somebody for an hour, won't they? Well, you had to divide that hour by at least four, and that was about the length of the time that you got. And before you knew where you were, you see, you were a driver. And it was then, really, that you learned how to drive.
So 15 minutes
experience.
And you're a driver.
Well, yes, I should think that over about 2 months, if we give it 2 months, that would be about it. 2 months training, which would be, I mean, in addition to whatever else that was required we should do. I mean, we had rifle practice. We marched to Rolston, where they had a firing range. and march back, which was a bit of a trial to a number of people who had not done any walking. Well, again, we'd done a fair amount of walking because we'd been associated with scouts and what have you. And also bayonet practice. And then there were lectures on sort of things. We'd got started with aircraft recognition. I think that was something that they'd introduced pretty soon, you know. First aid. I forget now altogether. But it seemed to occupy a great deal of the days.
And you weren't in a battalion as yet?
No, we were purely at the barracks. No, we were in... It wasn't until... excuse me. 1940. That we became the 8th Battalion of the East Yorks. And we were based on Beverley Westwood. And I was then in the MT platoon of that battalion. And 434-5822, that was my number. Let's never forget that.
And what are your next memories?
1940, we were wait a moment. Before that happened, of course, people were being sent to France from the barracks. They weren't allocated to any particular battalion here, but they were put into, it would be the 4th Battalion in those days, and were in France. Meanwhile, we moved from Beverley to Hornsey. And in the May of 1940, which was Dunkirk, there were 90 of us in Hornsey that had been allocated from the barracks. And our task was to protect the coastline, which was about 5 miles either side of Hornsey. So that 90 people were going to protect at least 10 miles of coastline in case of invasion. We had a post where we took in turns. It was the Coast Guard station at Hornsey. And we slept there overnight. And I remember I was on duty there that night, and that period of time when Dunkirk happened. And of course we'd got no equipment after that, so we were given permission to commandeer whatever we wanted. I mean, we lost. It's amazing how much stuff we must have lost, Dunkirk and elsewhere. But we finished with no lorries, and so we were commandeering things like Ford 8s, you know, the smallest little Fords that we used to joke about, because we did move eventually to Sunderland, and you know, if the Ford 8 wheels got in the tram lines, you used to have to go to the tram sheds to turn round, as the tale was said. And we commandeered the bogey from the railway station, whatever, you know, it was. There was a Defence of the Realm Act, you see, which was implied, was enforced.
But you kept your rifles?
Oh, we had our rifles. That was another thing. We had a rifle, and we had this 10 miles of coastline, and we had a box of ammunition. And so, jokingly, we used to say to the good folks of Hornsey, "Fear not, we will look after you." I think we didn't know which way to take it, really.
Did you think the Germans would invade?
Yes, oh yes, yes. I think they missed a trick there, because we'd nothing to stop them. Nothing at all.
Did you think they'd invade on the East Riding?
No, no, I didn't. No, I thought that was... I mean, they put pillboxes up, defence posts, all the way along. And later, I spent time at West Hartlepool erecting defences, metal constructions with barbed wire between, on the beach. They did that down on the south coast as well, but why they should worry about the northeast, I don't know. But they did.
So you moved from Hornsey to Hartlepool and Sunderland?
Right, now then, Hornsey, we then formed the 8th Battalion on the westward, and then our journeys began, because the first move after we'd spent 6 weeks or so, we recruited, obviously, to the battalion people who were called up at the later stages. So we were, in fact, getting older men. No, I mean, we were getting people in their 30s called up. And we then moved into Sunderland, in the northeast, which was quite a happy time, really, because they were so kind, with the people of the northeast. They really did treat us well. I was in Dykeland's drill hall at Roker.